Back together, you and I, to wrap up a very busy week, Friday, March 4th, 2022, right here on Connecticut Today. We spoke with Journal Inquirer Manchester columnist Chris Powell on the current Ukraine-Russia situation and whether or not the world should have seen Vladimir Putin's aggression coming. We featured comments from Secretary of State Antony Blinken on the Ukraine-Russia battle situation. And Dr. Diana Giornita joined us. She offered some suggestions to make life easier on America's front line doctors, including her suggested expansion of the use of so-called direct primary care arrangements. Back for his monthly check-in. We love to have him on. He's got a new column coming out. He does that every few days. Chris Powell, Journal Inquirer of Manchester, is with us to hit us with some of his observations and wisdom. And Chris, it's Paul.
Hey,
here. How are you?
Great to be with you, Paul.
Interesting that your part of your column, your upcoming column for the weekend, has to do with something that my phones were hot and heavy on, Chris, for the last 2 days. You know, do we stop importing Russian oil? And I find it interesting, Chris, that the White House says, no, we don't want to go there yet. And Nancy Pelosi yesterday says, of course we should stop Russian oil. I think it's a good microcosm here, Chris, of one hand not knowing what the other is doing, at least at this point.
Well, listen, it's the same issue in Europe right now. You know, the West is posing as being very tough on Russia, but it's not really. You go around Connecticut, you see the restaurants and liquor stores taking Russian vodka off the shelves, and some of the vodka they're taking off their shelves, well, it has, you know, Russian brand names. It's actually made in the United States, so it's getting punished for that. But vodka is not the big foreign exchange producer for Russia. You know, oil and gas are the big foreign exchange producers. You can stop drinking Russian vodka, and it will not do anything. You know, the question is, as Senator Markey in Massachusetts asked this week, are we going to stop using Russian oil, which accounts for about 8% of our imports? That's not 8% of our use, but it's 8% of our imports. So last year, we seem to be importing about 200,000 barrels of Russian oil a day and paid $17 billion to Russia for it. And that is what is going to finance Russia's war in Ukraine. So the question is, as you were asking a little while ago, are Americans ready to pay $4, $5, or $6 a gallon for gasoline in order to punish Russia for its invasion? And so far, the administration's answer is no. We haven't stopped, as you note, the Russian oil imports, and we haven't even turned off the banking system to the Russian banks. We've talked about doing it in principle, but it's still operating today. In his State of the Union speech, the president did not identify any Russian banks that were being turned off. And as of this morning, as far as I could see, at least the two biggest Russian banks, Sberbank and Gazprom Bank, were still operating through the SWIFT system, because our Western allies, at least, and probably the United States as well, still want to import Russian oil and gas, and to be able to pay for it, lest Russia turns it off. So I don't think the Western position toward Ukraine here and Russia is really very tough at all yet.
You know, Chris, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I kind of mused the other day, kind of exactly what you said. We're talking a big game, Chris, but I wonder, and I'm sure this is happening, any president here or leaders of Congress would call in the experts, Chris, right, from all the financial industry and the oil sector and say, you know, I hate to say it, Chris, but I'm sure they're almost saying, well, you know, is, as callous as this sounds, you know, is saving Ukraine worth trashing the entire world energy structure? And maybe, Chris, that's what Vladimir Putin is hoping the debate may be about, as diabolical as he may be.
Well, certainly Putin knew of Europe's dependence on Russian oil and gas, and he certainly knew that the United States was aware of that. And I'm sure that is one thing that gave him the courage to invade Ukraine. He figured that the West was just too dependent on Russian energy to do much about it. Listen, our whole strategy toward energy in Ukraine, Paul, has been insane. I mean, the Biden administration basically has crippled our energy production in the name of taking all in favor of green energy. But before green energy is available to replace oil and gas. So, you know, we killed our energy independence before we were ready to replace oil and gas with wind and solar and other green energy. And in Ukraine, we have been running that poor country as a provocation to Russia for 10 or 15 years without making Ukraine able to defend itself. What did we do first? We negotiated with the Soviet Union as it was crumbling over its cooperation with the reunification of Germany back in 1991. It wasn't put into any treaty, but there were assurances given, and it was really generally agreed that, look, if Russia allowed Germany to reunite, NATO would not expand eastward, and Russia would have some buffer as it pulled out of its, you know, satellite countries in Eastern Europe. That was very sensible. It was good policy. It was considered good policy on both sides, in the West and in Russia. Buffers between great powers are really good ideas for keeping the peace. But we broke that understanding. The Russians foolishly forgot to put it into any treaty they had with us. So since that time, what have we done? We've put the Eastern European former satellite states into NATO and even abutting right on Russia's border. And now we were tempting Ukraine with NATO after we helped overthrow the elected Ukrainian government that was friendly to Russia. And now we were tempting Ukraine with NATO membership. I mean, this was provocation after provocation by the West to Russia, which kept saying, listen, we don't want NATO and nuclear weapons from NATO right on our border. Russia's been saying this for years. But even as we were provoking Russia this way, did we make Ukraine able to defend itself against this invasion? Did we fill Ukraine with the Javelin missiles and the anti-tank weapons and the anti-aircraft missiles, the Stingers? No, you know, we didn't. Did we give the Ukrainian Air Force A-10 Warthog planes that are tank destroyers? No, we didn't. We kept getting Ukraine to provoke Russia and provoke Russia, and then bingo, Russia decides, no, okay, we're not going to be peaceful anymore. We're going to attack because you guys don't care about giving us any security guarantees, and Ukraine is unready to defend itself. We now in the United States, we're unprepared to replace the Russian oil that we're importing. I mean, this was all foreseeable. Putin foresaw it. Why didn't we?
Good question. Chris, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We'll turn our sights toward things here in Connecticut vis-a-vis what's going on with the governor and the debate or the non-debate over crime in the state continues. More monthly check-in with Chris Powell, Manchester Journal Inquirer, straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. 600 AM, 107.3 FM and online to WICC600.com. Our monthly check-in with Chris Powell, former managing editor and still columnist at the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Chris, closer to home, there's a tired newscaster segue there. Closer to home, Chris, the governor's situation here with the contracting scandal, which has now taken another turn, another grand jury investigation here, another request here for more grand jury action. The governor looked a little shell-shocked in that news conference the other day when when Melissa McCall, quote-unquote, resigned and wasn't fired. Does this get tighter, Chris, for the governor eventually, or do you think we still don't know the extent of this yet?
I don't think we know enough about it, Paul, to draw any hard conclusion. I mean, the governor certainly has looked weak and I think a little befuddled by the whole thing. He purported to want McCaw to to stay on as budget secretary and wanted to be friends with her, but she did not even show up for the press conference at which he announced her her resignation. He issued a statement in which he and McCaw, you know, thanked each other, but certainly there's bad feeling there about her departure. And I think certainly what we've seen so far in the federal investigation is, and the comments about it from people involved, there certainly was contract steering in these school construction projects that McCaw's deputy was sending these contracts to certain companies that he felt were more qualified, and that really was cutting down on competitive bidding. But did was there any kickback from these companies? Were any of them other than the one we know about? Were any of these companies other companies employing his daughter? And she was working at one of these school construction consulting companies. Was certainly as corrupt on its face. But you know, how much more impropriety? We don't know yet. The governor's got to hope that this goes away quickly, because if there are indictments in the middle of the gubernatorial campaign, that's going to be very harmful to him.
Sure. And finally, Chris, something you point out in your latest column, we seem to, Chris, at least some members of the General Assembly, not everybody on either side of the aisle, but we still seem to have an inability, Chris, to have an adult specific conversation on the legislative level about crime and who is committing some crimes and what has to be done early on in the process to get them to stop.
Yeah, so much of the crime problem in Connecticut, Paul, is a matter of repeat offenders. I think if you read the papers closely, as I do, you'll find that nearly all the serious and atrocious crimes are being attributed to people who have long criminal records. I mean, the phrase "long criminal record" these days is a cliche. You know, we don't have any three strikes law in Connecticut. We don't have a 10 strikes law in Connecticut. And even as these repeat offenders keep doing awful things and getting accused in public and making known their long criminal records, our legislators really refuse to look at this repeat offender problem. There was one senator, Manchester State Senator Steve Cassano, mm-hmm. made a remark at a community forum in Manchester the other day, saying that, the big problem was repeat offenders, and you know, if we could do something about them, we'd really cut the crime rate down. I think he's right. He didn't propose any specific legislation like making juvenile court public, so we can see how the repeat offenders among the juveniles are handled and who keeps letting them out. But while we see the repeat offender problem increasingly now, the governor keeps boasting about the decline in Connecticut's prison population. Well, you know, the one reason we have so many crimes committed by repeat offenders is because they've been let out of prison.
Chris, serious question, finally, to wrap up here. You know, doesn't the Democratic leadership, by far, we know it's them, don't they think that members who vote for them, you know, their own constituents, don't they think that they want to live in safe neighborhoods too? What are they so afraid of, Chris Powell, of saying, yeah, as Commissioner Rovella said a couple of weeks ago, there are 100 to 300 really bad people who probably should be inside in this state. What's the fear about, Chris? I don't get it.
Well, some Democratic legislators are coming around a little bit in the posturing they do, but I think the real problem in the party is that Democrats are afraid that a close look at crime is going to show, as we already know, but it'll emphasize, that crime is disproportionately a matter of race, just because poverty is disproportionately a matter of race. And I think they're just afraid to acknowledge that. We have a poverty problem, and it becomes a racial problem, but we can't address it because our solutions that we advance fail. I mean, we've been working on poverty for 50 years. We've been working on educational reform for 50 years, and nothing gets better. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is what they don't want to discuss. They don't want to discuss the failure of these expensive welfare and educational policies.
Chris, thank you. Have a good weekend. Please stay away from the Russian vodka. You can use whatever you'd like, but have a good weekend, Chris, okay?
You too, Paul.
All right, Chris Powell. Thanks, Chris, former managing editor, now great columnist still at the Journal Inquirer of Manchester.
These and other efforts by our European allies to deepen their own capabilities and cooperation do not undermine the Transatlantic Security Alliance. They deepen our collective might. As recently as a few weeks ago, some questioned whether, if the regional or international rules-based order came under threat, whether our European allies and partners would be willing to shoulder their fair share of the burden, the risk, the cost to defend it. In the last 9 days, European countries have demonstrated they are more than ready to stand up and stand together. And the United States is standing with Europe, pursuing complementary actions and policies in close coordination with our allies and partners. To give just a few examples, we've deployed an additional 7,000 troops to Europe and repositioned our forces already on the continent to strengthen NATO's eastern flank. We continue to tighten our severe economic sanctions on Russia. Last night, as I think you know, we extended temporary protective status to tens of thousands of Ukrainians living in the United States. And the president has requested an additional $10 billion from Congress to deliver more humanitarian, security, and economic assistance in Ukraine and the surrounding region over the coming days and weeks. Yesterday, President Putin said his so-called special military operation is proceeding exactly as planned. Well, it's hard to imagine that his plan included inspiring the Ukrainian people to defend their country with such tenacity, strengthening the resolve and solidarity of NATO and the EU, uniting the world in opposition to Moscow, including 141 countries, at the United Nations, an unprecedented number of international businesses, associations, cultural institutions that have cut ties with Russia, causing the Russian economy to go into freefall, motivating tens of thousands of Russians to protest and countless more to leave the country, and increasingly turning Russia into a pariah state. If that was President Putin's plan, well, you can say it's working. Russia has never been so isolated. We have never been more united. But let me reiterate one thing, because it's very important. We take these actions not because we oppose the Russian people. We do not. We regret that tens of millions of Russians will suffer because of the dangerous decisions made by a tiny circle of corrupt leaders and their cronies who have consistently put their interests above those of the Russian people, who are doing everything they can to hide their war of choice from the Russian public. Today's discussion with NATO, the EU, the G7, affirmed that we're fully aligned on our goals and our determination to meet them. We'll deepen our support for Ukraine's brave defenders and for the Ukrainian civilians suffering as a result of the deepening humanitarian crisis. We'll continue to raise the cost for President Putin and all who carry out and enable his war of choice and the devastation that it's causing. We'll continue to strengthen our capacity to defend our collective security and deter further escalation by Russia, including by upholding our Article 5 commitment that an attack on one is an attack on all. NATO's a defensive alliance. We've never sought and will not seek conflict with Russia. But as President Biden has said, we will defend every inch of NATO territory. No one should doubt America's readiness or our resolve. At the same time, we'll keep open the door to dialogue and diplomacy, while making clear to the Kremlin that unless it changes course, it will continue down the road of increasing isolation and economic pain. And we'll support Ukraine and its talks with Russia to reach a ceasefire and the unconditional withdrawal of Russian forces, something that Foreign Minister Kuleba and I have been discussing on a daily basis. In the meantime, we are working urgently with the government of Ukraine, the ICRC, and others to create humanitarian corridors that will allow civilians to get out of Ukraine's besieged cities and to allow food, medicine, and other vital supplies to get in. Russia's attack created this humanitarian crisis. Now, all countries have a responsibility to pressure the Kremlin to alleviate at least some of the misery that it has wrought. Of all the consequences of Moscow's unprovoked attack, one of the most unexpected is the spark it has lit in people around the world who've come out to demonstrate for freedom, for the rights of Ukrainians. That includes valiant individuals in places where protesting the Kremlin's war means risking arrest, beatings, or worse, as thousands of Russians and Belarusians have done. For years, we've seen the dangerous tide rolling back democracy and human rights and undercutting the rules-based order, fueled in no small part by Moscow. With this brutal invasion, we, our European allies and partners and people everywhere, are being reminded of just how much is at stake. Now, we see the tide of democracy rising to the moment. With that, I'm happy to take some questions.
Paul Hanley, AFP.
This is Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking after a meeting of NATO and EU leaders.
The West has put unprecedented sanctions on Russia, very punishing. Yet it doesn't seem to have slowed the Russian military's advance on Ukraine. Today, NATO seemed to forswear absolutely putting in a no-fly zone that might protect the Ukrainians. Given that, nothing seems to have slowed this invasion. What can you tell the Ukrainian people who only see things getting worse, seeing a disaster, seeing more suffering, and are pleading for more help from the West? And I have a little follow-up. I could ask it now or in a moment.
No, go ahead, please.
The West, NATO, has been involved in this in terms of supplying a lot of arms, which you've mentioned, to Ukraine. Can't it supply more more effective arms, larger weapons, jets have been talked about. NATO is engaged in this. Can't it do more for Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let me take the second part first. We're in constant contact with Ukraine, with government officials and leaders on their needs. And in constant contact and coordination with allies and partners on providing for those needs when it comes to security assistance. We've already been engaged in a remarkable effort, just speaking for the United States, with the various drawdowns that President Biden has done. We've provided over the past year and change more than $1 billion in security assistance to Ukraine. The most recent drawdown that was issued by the president of $350 million. We have already sent into Ukraine about $250 million worth of that drawdown. So this is happening every single day, and you're seeing the means that Ukraine needs to defend itself get into the hands of Ukrainians who are doing that. Having said that, one of the things that we talked about at length today in our various meetings at NATO and the EU was what more we can do and how to do it effectively. I would add that I think, as you know, Foreign Minister Kuleba actually came into our meetings by video. We heard from him directly. Some of the additional things that that Ukraine is looking for, we're working on all of that every single day. We're also a week and change in to this horrific war wrought by Russia. We've had already a dramatic impact far beyond, I think, what anyone would have expected on Russia and its economy. The ruble is trading at its weakest levels ever. It's worth less than a penny. Russian authorities are expecting exporters to sell at least 80% of the foreign currency that they have to prop up what is a rapidly weakening currency. The stock market's been closed for days. Due to a fear of capital flight once it opens. This is the longest stretch of emergency closure since Russia defaulted back in the 1990s.
Take a little bit of a break now in this segment talking about, well, something we talk about here on the show all the time, healthcare. Believe me, I know. I'm paying off a couple of bills. I'm fine. Don't worry. Mr. and Mrs. Kidney Stone came to visit a couple of weeks ago. We're all fine. Don't worry. But yes, I have an easy payment plan. There you go. It's all right. But there's a constant worry that the system is stressed and we have great doctors, great nurses, great technology. You know, my procedure was in and out and in an hour or so it was great. But it's the monetary factor. It's the stress on doctors. And there's not a lot of help coming from the feds on that. And joining us today is Dr. Diana Giornita. She diagnoses and treats adult patients for a wide array of inflammatory arthritis, osteoarthritis, arthritis, autoimmune diseases, and osteoporosis. If you go to the website realclearhealth.com, she has an interesting essay there. Doctors are at a breaking point. Doctor, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you today?
I'm doing great, very well. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Well, it says doctors are at a breaking point. You know, that's not a good headline, doctor. I mean, we rely on our medical professionals like you, but I hear it from my doctors, too, the specialists I see and my GP, who's a wonderful lady, but they vent their frustration at me at how the system is just not helping them. Talk a little about that.
I think that there is a unified opinion about things that are not working in the healthcare system, especially among us. We started to vent to patients, as you were saying, because we are basically the face of the healthcare system. When you go to, when you have a medical problem, you're going to go to a doctor, and that's the way that patients kind of see the healthcare system. We are the representative. So when we feel frustrated about things that are happening and are out of our controls, we started to tell patients that it's not our fault that they don't get what they need when they need it the most, actually.
Give me a couple of examples, doctor, and I know you've outlined a couple of things here you think would help. What are the biggest problems? So when myself or anybody goes to see our GP, and maybe we get referred to a specialist, but when we go to see a GP, what's their day like? What makes it hard for them, as well-intentioned as they are, to give us the best care? What are the pressures building on America's frontline doctors?
There are many things that could be said, but I will try to outline a few of them.
Sure.
So first of all, we are part of the system and we have to run accordingly. We have to run as the system is dictating us. Our schedules are compacted every single day, and it's very hard for us to kind of manage the schedule. If you want to add another patient, because there are many patients and there are not enough doctors, it's very difficult for us, because you have to either take from the time of the patient or of other patients, or take from your own time. And what's happening most of the time, we kind of take from our own time. So in time, doctors do become frustrated. And then, you know, we are paid based on the documentation that we make. So instead of concentrating all our attention on patients, we have to, you know, look at the computer and start typing notes and typing, you know, all kind of information that the system is requiring to be typed there, but it doesn't help the patient. And then when you want to order tests and, you know, imaging studies, you have to send the patient where the system will direct you to send them, you know, into the same network.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's not based on the value that we see. And most of us, we don't even know or have any idea about the cost that we generate. Actually, I believe that probably 80% of the doctors that are employed today have absolutely no idea how much a consultation of theirs, I mean, their time, their expertise, is valued, and they don't have any idea how much, you know, how much they will generate if they order certain tests. I mean, they don't know how much the patient will pay for a test or for an imaging study, for a medication, which, again, if we want to help the system, we have to be aware about those things. To, you know, not to put too much financial pressure on the patient.
And, you know, doctor, it's interesting. A specialist I just saw for my kidney stones, he was, you know, and we were talking about it, and he was asking me about what the final charges were. And I told him, and he was, you know, he was really surprised. Now, back to what you said. He was almost apologetic and said, well, if you look, my fee was only, and I said, nah, I don't have a problem with that, doctor. I thought your fee for the hour and a half that you were with me, and it's a tricky procedure, I understand that. I thought your fee was fine. It was all the other stuff, but Dr. Janita, as you just said, there was my specialist not really knowing what the intricacies of my final bill was going to be.
Yes, that's true. So the surprise bills in our days are something common. So although many patients, they pay their, their health care plans, and they're very good about, even putting money on the side. If they have a high deductible plan, they want to put money aside. They cannot use those money most of the time for things that they consider appropriate for their health. So I mentioned here that in this article about the health saving account,
yeah.
That only people that have a high deductible plan will be allowed to have. But I think that we shouldn't limit that to just those people that will have the high deductible plans. We should give the option to everybody that they want to put money aside for medical care to be able to do that. And after you have such an account, I will give you an example. These accounts, they have certain medical expenses that are approved, mm-hmm. and others that are not approved. And just to give you an example, if you want to use it for, let's say you want to pay a membership to a direct specialist or a direct primary care physician, you're not allowed to use that. Although those expenses are basically for your health, they're not expenses outside of the healthcare system, but you are not allowed to do that. And that's not right for those patients because they really work hard to put this money aside, and they should be let to use it in that regard.
Sure. Doctor, hang on. I want to come back. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to talk a little bit more about what you just talked about regarding this direct contracting of people, of a patient with a doctor. It's fascinating stuff. I know that upper-income people are trying to do it, but I agree, this is fascinating. Dr. Diana Giornita is the guest. More with her first. Traffic and weather together on WICC. All right, back to open phones momentarily. News top of the hour. Another check of traffic and weather together. Straight ahead, talking with Dr. Diana Giornita. She has an op-ed and a very good one at realclearhealth.com. And you know the Real Clear sites. There's Real Clear Politics, Real Clear Sports. They really branched out over the years. And now there's realclearhealth.com. Dr. Giornita, this is interesting. I've actually read about this, and you like to see an expansion of what they call direct primary care, which, correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, this is essentially an individual or a family saying that there's a doctor they like, and you can contract with a fee, a negotiated fee with that doctor, correct, to have that doctor pretty much on call when they are needed and to provide certain services, eliminating part of the office visit fee. But you say this is not happening as much as it should be.
Yes. So as you all know, primary care is the foundation and should be the foundation of our healthcare system. We should expand primary care to access to primary care because this is the way that patients will get what they need. Of course, we need more specialists, but if we don't have enough primary care physicians, the system will suffer, of course. But this concept is not new. Direct primary care concept is basically a reestablishment of the relationship between doctors and patients. If you remember the old days, the doctor will have a direct relationship with the patient, and
yeah.
nobody else will intervene. And that's a sacred, I would say, relationship that should be preserved. You know, the physicians that get very close to their patients, they will have the highest success in treating the patient because the trust, if you have the trust of the patient, they will do whatever you recommend to do. And this movement, direct primary care, started about 10 years ago in the United States. It expanded and it's still expanding. And now, specialists like me and others are kind of trying to mimic this movement. So the idea is that you're going to contract directly with the doctor, and the doctor will provide his services for a fair market price, I would say. Everything is disclosed, everything is transparent, and everything is accessible. And when you need the medical care, you have the doctor who will provide it to you. And if you don't like it, you stop the contract and you move on. But that doesn't happen usually. So those doctors, they also have direct contracts with laboratory services, with imaging centers, and with also with pharmacies that will offer cash prices for everything. But those cash prices are very discounted. So if you compare, and I will give you an example. If you compare basic labs, because I would like people to understand, if you compare basic labs for, an yearly checkup, it's going to be about $40 in a direct primary care facility or in a direct primary care practice. If you go to the hospital, the same labs will probably be at least $400, okay?
Wow.
So the price is incredibly. If you want to get an MRI through a direct primary care practice, the cost will be $400. If you go to the hospital, it will be at least $4,000. So those are the huge differences, of course. So when I hear people that this is concierge medicine, this is not concierge medicine. This is, you know, or you can call it concierge concept, but without the price tag.
Sure. And doctor, in about the minute we have left, who or what is standing in the way of more availability to direct primary care? What's the problem here?
I think people are so used to the idea that they can get medical care only with insurance that they don't know about this option. So I think this option should be open and should let people to understand that they have alternatives, and patients should look for alternatives in our days because they exist and they will expand more and more.
The op-ed, check it out. It's on realclearhealth.com. The guest has been Dr. Diana Giornita, MD. She diagnoses and treats adult patients for a wide range of inflammatory arthritis, runs in my family, osteoarthritis, autoimmune diseases, and osteoporosis. Doctor, thank you. We appreciate the time. Good luck in the future, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. There you go. How about that, folks, huh? How about that? If you were allowed to have a direct primary care setup with a doctor who then contracts all everything else under them so you're not paying five or six different people, what did she say? The lab tests for an annual physical would be $40 versus $400, direct primary care versus an insurance company. And an MRI, which would be $400 about, through a direct primary care arrangement with an individual doctor like families used to do, that would be $4,000. Yikes.